12, and I'd just like to introduce our speaker tonight, Professor Paul Ewart. Professor Ewart is head of the Department of Atomic and Laser Physics here at Oxford. He's a graduate of Queen's University Belfast, and he has been an SERC Advanced Fellow at Imperial College London, a Royal Academy of Engineering Senior Research Fellow at Oxford, visiting fellow at the Joint Institute of Laboratory Astrophysics, and lots of other things. I mean, he's a very well-accomplished man. His research involves laser studies of molecular physics with applications to combustion, environmental, and cell biology. He's a member of Kidlington Baptist Church, married with two children, and has recently become a grandfather. So I'd just like to introduce, invite you, Professor Ewart, to speak to us on chaos and the character of God.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you for your invitation. I have spoken once or twice at my college, CU, to the undergraduates there, and although I've been in Oxford for about 30 years, it's nice to eventually graduate. And here I am with the graduate CU, which is a pleasure to be here. And as the introduction said, we're going to be thinking together about this topic of chaos and the nature of God or the character of God. And by chaos, I want to use that term to encompass essentially anything that arises by chance, because really it's the issue of chance that manifests itself in chaos in the world around us, or even in our own lives. Let's be honest, they're sometimes a bit more chaotic than they ought to be. We had a kind of love-hate relationship with chance in the Christian community right from its very beginning. We'll be exploring, I hope, some of the theological issues arising from the concept of chance as to whether it's real or illusory, and what that might mean for the character of God and our relationship with him. And in fact, I came across a lovely story by Rabbi Lionel Blue, who you may have heard of, a famous broadcaster, amongst other things. And he tells the story of a Jewish businessman. That introduction is necessary so that I can tell a joke about a Jewish businessman without being accused of being racist. Okay, so it was Lionel Blue who tells this story. The businessman got into difficulties with his business, and he needed a cash input. And so he went to the synagogue and prayed, "Dear Lord, it would be just great if I could win the lottery. That would solve my problems. So could you fix it?" And he went away, and a week passed. He didn't win the lottery, so he went back and prayed again. "Lord, you know the serious difficulties I'm in, and I need this cash injection, and that would really get me out of this hole. Please fix it that I could win the lottery." Another week passed, still no jackpot. This went on for several weeks, and eventually he went back to the synagogue full of exasperation and cried out, "Dear God, please, you know how much I need this money. Please help me to win the lottery." And then into the synagogue boomed this heavenly voice saying, "I hear you, my son, but meet me halfway. Buy a ticket." So, and I'm not going to build a theology on a joke, but I think it illustrates the kind of equivocal nature or feelings we have about chance in our lives, whether we feel that God is in control of every detail, or whether in fact there are things that happen just by chance, and that even they are outside, in some sense, God's control. But I'm coming at this subject as a scientist, and as you know, perhaps modern science that developed in the 16th and 17th century was really founded upon this idea that creation was the product of a God of order, that God had created a world that could be understood, and therefore it made sense to think about some underlying structure and orderliness that would be there by virtue of God's faithfulness and God's dependability. And there was very much the idea that for several of the founding fathers of the Royal Society, for example, who were very devout Christians, they felt that God could be revealed not only in the book of his word, but in the book of his world, so that to look at the world might tell us something about the nature of God. And they based that, of course, on several sound scriptural principles. that at the very beginning, in the book of Genesis, we read that the earth was without form and void. Picture of formless chaos. And the Spirit of God hovered upon the face of the waters. And apparently the waters is, in Hebrew thought, symbolic of chaos and disorder. And one reason, perhaps, some people have speculated that that's why the Jewish or the Israelite people weren't very good sailors. They didn't really like boats and the unpredictable storms that could come up on the oceans. And we all recall how frightened the disciples were when they were caught out in a storm on the Sea of Galilee. So here we see at the beginning, God bringing order to the primeval chaos. And that theme appears occasionally through the Old Testament. For example, in Hosea, he reminds the Israelites that it is God and his faithfulness that is the cause of the regularity of their harvests. And it's not due to the sacrifices that they may have been making to pagan gods, that underneath the world is a faithful, dependable God. And Psalm 19 reminds us that the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament showeth his handiwork. And the psalmist begins by looking at the glory of nature and God's creation, and then moves seamlessly, as it were, into talking about the moral law. That just as the world is ordered by natural laws, so we are to be ordered by a moral law that will search us out, just as the sunlight penetrates to the nooks and crannies of that sunny land. And then Paul in Romans reminds his readers that what can be known about God, namely his power and deity, can be seen in the things that he has made. And that's the kind of manifesto of natural theology, as it were, that by looking at God's creation we can learn something about him. So there are scriptural principles that we can look to justify thinking about God by thinking about what's going on in nature. That God is a God of order, and that leads us to the concept of natural laws that science has been very successful in finding out. Because it's not obvious, of course, that nature would have an orderly structure. That everywhere we look in nature, we see chaos, we see randomness. You go for a walk in the woods, and trees are random shapes. The floor is littered with random array of stones and leaves. And that's part of its charm and its beauty, is it not? And we go into the countryside and see perhaps even a dry stone wall. And it's kind of soothing. Beauty seems to arise partly from the irregularity and gentle chaos in the shapes. If everywhere we went all the walls looked like Lego, we'd soon get bored. And somehow this natural chaos is restful to our spirits. But nonetheless, by doing careful experiments, the early scientists and we are today are in their following their footsteps, find a very deep order in nature and the universe, all the way down to the tiniest particles that make up the whole universe, that we see a structure and a faithfulness that reflects the orderliness of God. Well, that was all very well, and on that basis, people like Newton and Kepler could justify their natural theology, that the world spoke of a God of order. And there were some kind of theological downsides to that, of course, because seeing the world as a well-ordered machine soon led to the idea that this machine could run on its own. It was just a giant clockwork that God had somehow wound up and set going, and he was now outside the machine, and therefore had left it to its own devices, as it were. And so arose, well, for one reason, that was one reason for the growth of deism. It was, of course, at the same time in the 17th century, a general reaction against organized religion because of its excesses and its corruptions. But nonetheless, there was that sense that if God was real, he certainly didn't seem to be involved in his creation anymore, that he could be outside the machine. culminating in Laplace's famous remark when Napoleon asked him about his theories, that they seem to exclude God, and he replied that he had no longer any need for that hypothesis, that the world could be understood without God, that it was an orderly, tidy machine. And science was built on the idea that we could find this order by designing experiments specifically to keep out random chance interventions so that we could get repeatable results every time. But more modern science, I'm thinking now of the 20th and 21st centuries, and indeed some of the work that I'm doing myself, comes face to face eventually with the fact that nature isn't actually ordered in the way we'd like it to be sometimes. And in fact, we find at the deepest level there's a very unsettling disorder and indeterminacy, a chaos at the heart of creation, if you will. That's quantum theory, which is the best theory of anything that people have ever had, ever, has at its core an indeterminacy, an uncertainty, a lack of order, if you will. It even undermines our whole ideas of causality, of continuity. So it's very unsettling, because if that's the nature of the world that God has made, what does that tell us about God? If on the one hand we could say there's an order in nature, therefore there's an orderly God who made it, and then we look now and find that actually at its heart it's disordered and chaotic and just left to random chance, what does that say about God? Of course, there are many people who would simply say that that proves that there is no God. Or if there is, he isn't the God of the Bible, the God of Jesus, a personal God. Einstein is famous for being very unhappy, as it were, with this idea of indeterminacy. And he spent most of his life trying to find a way around this uncertainty in quantum theory, which he had contributed to, but nonetheless was deeply unhappy with. He was at heart a determinist, and he wrote this: "Everything is determined by forces over which we have no control. It is determined for the insect as well as for the star. Human beings, vegetables, or cosmic dust, we all dance to a mysterious tune intoned in the distance by an invisible piper." Everything for Einstein was the result of a logical sequence of cause and effect. And therefore, when it came to realizing that this world in which we live is marred by evil, the evil that men do, by the suffering that people endure in life, he concluded that the idea of a personal God was incoherent, because if everything was determined and God was determining it, then he was responsible for the evil in the world. And therefore, when he came to judge the world, he would be judging himself, a kind of self-defeating philosophy. And so he concluded that the idea of a personal God is quite alien to me, said Einstein, and seems even naive. So on the one hand, Einstein is arguing that because things are underneath somehow, even underneath the chaos of quantum theory, there's an underlying determinism that we just haven't discovered yet. That was his feeling. And there are many people who share that theory, that there are sort of a hiddenness in the universe that we just haven't been able to discover that would explain the apparent randomness of quantum theory. So that if there is this determinism ultimately, that would mean God could not be personal. So I want to just raise the question that if things aren't determined, if there's an indeterminacy in our world, is the corollary then that God is personal? It's not a logical sealed deal, as it were, but it's an interesting question to put. So chance lies, as I've said, in whatever form, at the heart of modern science. And let me just be clear that there are two kinds of chance that people think about. There is a chance that I might bump into a friend tomorrow because I don't know what he's doing and I might just bump into him by chance. So that meeting would arise because of my lack of knowledge of his plans and his whereabouts. And there's lots of things like that. We don't know who's going to win the 3:30 at Newmarket tomorrow because we haven't got enough information. And if we did, we'd be able to predict what the outcome of that would be. If you have any information, just have a word with me afterwards. So there are things that we just can't work out because we don't know enough about the situation. And that's, if you like, epistemological chance. I'm going to use two big words. That's one of them. And the second one, let's get over with, is ontological chance. Chance that is there by virtue of the nature of existence. It just is at the heart of things. Just by their nature, things are random and unpredictable. So both kinds of chance have been considered by philosophers and theologians down the years. And both of them actually seem to raise theological problems. Because, I mean, if, for example, the world is a product of pure chance, doesn't that rule out the existence of God? And that reminds me that just to deal with an issue that you may have heard about recently, and this is the idea that the whole universe came into being as a result of pure chance. The Big Bang was just what they call a quantum fluctuation. Now, you don't have to know what this means to get the idea. What they're saying is that the universe kind of made itself. It just appeared for no reason. And that we can understand this by virtue of what's called a quantum fluctuation. And the idea there is, supposing we were to take everything out of this room, all people, all the chairs, the furniture, even every molecule of gas was evacuated from this room and we filled it with a vacuum in a sense, there's nothing in here, we would still find that in that vacuum there's a kind of fluctuating field. And this is what we find in our experiments, that the vacuum is really empty. There's this underlying wiggle and that causes things to happen when you put it into the vacuum. And so the idea is that because if you make the best nothing you can, there's still this wiggling that causes things to happen. And one of these wiggles that led to the Big Bang, here we are, pop. And so people conclude that therefore the universe can be explained just as one of these pure chance events. Now, if you feel intimidated by this, you oughtn't to, because it's nonsense. But it's put about by reasonably intelligent people. In fact, if you were in the Sheldonian last week, you may have heard Richard Dawkins quote this idea, and I noticed many people nodding knowingly that yes, this explains everything. Well, actually it explains nothing. And it confuses what we mean by nothing in the common sense or philosophical sense with what we mean by nothing in physics. Nothing is what you have in our universe when you take everything out that you can and you're left with a vacuum. But you haven't got rid of the universe. You haven't got rid of the laws of physics. Where did they come from? Did they just pop into existence as well? Well, no, they didn't, because the nothing that quantum theory is talking about is the zero point energy of a field, we say. Now, don't get worried about the physics of here, but trust me that it isn't nothing. And therefore, it's a misuse of the term nothing to say that the universe could just appear out of nothing. Something had to be there to establish the laws of quantum theory and the vacuum, which was fluctuating. So it doesn't remove the problem of existence, why there is something rather than nothing, as Leibniz would have put it. But nonetheless, chance has been used as a stick to beat believers with for many years. Most famously recently, I suppose, the latest onslaught of the new atheism grew out of a book called Chance and Necessity by Jacques Monod, who was a Nobel Prize-winning molecular biologist. And he wrote this book, I think, around 1957 or thereabouts. And in it, he writes this. Man at last knows that he is alone in the unfeeling immensity of the universe. out of which he emerged by chance. And building on that idea, people like Richard Dawkins and so on in The Blind Watchmaker have argued that the randomness in nature and evolution points to the lack of a mind behind the universe. It has no purpose in minds. If there was a watchmaker, it was a blind watchmaker, and we see just the effects of blind chance. And therefore, there's no purpose in our existence and no purposeful creator. So the new atheists put great store by this idea of chance undermining belief in God. Now, it's interesting to note that creationists and intelligent design proponents would agree with them. They would argue that you can't have chance and God as well. That for them, chance doesn't exist. That God is actually in control of everything. It may look like chance to us, but secretly God's pulling all the strings. And therefore there's no such thing as chance. Chance is a delusion. So on the one hand, either chance is real and God is a delusion, or God is real and chance is a delusion. But I don't want to put the two polar extremes, as it were, and say that if we get the balance between those, we've got it right, because actually the balance is a tip very much against chance, because most theologians down the years have also felt that chance is an illusion, that it's a result of our ignorance and nothing more than that. Calvin, for example, is an example. He wrote, "There is nothing cheaper than a sparrow, and yet God's eye is upon it, and nothing happens to it by chance. Will he then, who looks after sparrows, neglect to watch over the lives of men?" So we have this great weight of opinion against the reality of chance, or at least the reality of chance and the existence of God, that they seem to be mutually exclusive. The idea is that it wouldn't make sense that a creator would leave anything to chance. But I want to actually question that tonight. I want to suggest to you that actually God has a very sound purpose in including chance in his creation. For Calvin, the problem was that if chance was real, then God was no longer sovereign. He was no longer in control of the fall of every sparrow or of the events of our lives. I want to suggest to you that paradoxically, God can only be in control if there is chance. And I hope to explain that as we go through. So, establishing the reality of chance is one thing, and let me give you a few examples. Most of you will be already familiar with the idea of randomness in biological evolution, that our best theory of how we have evolved is through the random mutations in our genes, and then the action of natural selection upon those random variations. So the competition for food or for survival acts upon these mutations to create a species that is suited for survival, and that's the basic theory of evolution, and it's the best theory we have for how we come to be here. So that's one example that's well known, but there, as I've intimated in physics, at the very foundation of nature itself, chance exists. And it occurred to me, as it happened, I was doing an experiment that unavoidably involved chance, and I didn't worry too much about the actual physics or the technicalities of it. But basically, I want to explain to you that when we are studying how things work, how atoms, of which we are made, absorb or emit light, then the quantum theory that we've all heard about will tell us whether that will happen. At least it'll tell us the probability it will happen. But it's possible, and it's often the case, that the probability will be zero, that some things just never happen. And that's deterministic, with a capital D. So the equations, as it were, the theory of quantum theory is very deterministic. It will tell you if something is impossible. And that comes about because sometimes two equal things cancel each other out and give a big fat zero. Nothing happens. Now, one of the experiments I was involved in was doing just that. Two things were going on together that cancel each other out, except that one of the things had a bit of randomness mixed into it, and that randomness actually cancelled the cancellation. It was a very weird destruction of a destruction, if you will. And it was purely the result of that chance nature of what was going on, that there was a randomness there that broke that deterministic iron fist that held it at zero. And what occurred to me then was that actually chance, randomness, maybe God's way of breaking free his creation from the iron grip of determinism and allowing us, his creatures, to be genuinely free ultimately. That if everything is determined, then there's no free will. We have no moral choice. God is pulling all the strings. And maybe we want to discuss some of the theological implications of that. For example, the very strong tradition of Reformed theology that sees all our lives as being predestined in every detail. What are the moral implications for that for God's character? Does he predetermine some of us for heaven and some of us for hell? And the choice that we seem to have is only an illusion, that actually God is doing it all along. Well, I'll lay my cards on the table. I'm deeply uncomfortable with that idea. And I want to argue that God has made things differently so that our choices are real and that we are truly morally responsible for our actions and our lives. We have a free choice to respond to his grace or to reject it. And it's on that free choice that God will judge us. But that's something perhaps we can discuss later. So I'm arguing that chance could have a very real purpose in God's creation. After all, as I alluded to earlier, at the beginning of Genesis, God made chaos in the first place. If he made everything out of nothing, then at one stage there was this formless chaos. So chaos was something on the way to creation. It had a positive role in creation. And that might be something that we also might consider. But there's this deeper problem. Supposing God were to allow chance a role in nature, does that mean he relinquishes control? Isn't that a bit risky? Why would he do that? Would he then lose his sovereignty? Now, particularly, I think this is a problem when it comes to the issue of suffering in the world. A few years ago, a Jewish rabbi, Harold Krishner, wrote a book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. It was a bestseller because it touched a nerve. Many of us feel there's something deeply disturbing about the undeserved suffering of many good people. And perhaps you even know some people, I do, whose faith has been shattered by the experience of personal suffering or the observation of the suffering of a loved one. Why do bad things happen to good people? Well, Kushner concluded that stuff happens. Not a very profound philosophical conclusion, but that was it. Stuff happens, and even God can't do anything about it. So we just have to make the best of it. And for some people, perhaps that was a comfort, but I suspect not for very many, and certainly not for every Jewish commentator. Another rabbi, a man called Kirchner, argued that from a Jewish perspective, that if what Kushner was saying was true, if he, that God was God, if God is not responsible for the bad, neither can he be credited with the good. So in other words, if we let God off the hook because he can't prevent these bad things happening, because he's not responsible for them, then he can't be responsible for anything good that happens either. So there's no comfort either way. So we have this problem, and for me, the problem of suffering is one thing, the fact that it exists, and for many people it's the biggest stumbling block to faith. And it certainly for me as a Christian, when I became a Christian, it was one of the things I struggled with for many, many years to make sense of it. And I haven't got the answer yet, but I do feel I'm working a way towards something, a resolution of it, because you see, one of the hardest thing to understand is not just that suffering exists, but the fact that it is random, that it seems to be so much down to chance, who gets sick, who has the car accident, who gets cancer. It doesn't seem to be ordered in any way that's related to anything that we would remotely think as fair. Why isn't God fair? Why doesn't he stop these bad things happening to good people? So it seemed to me that if we attack this problem at its hardest point, and the hardest point for me is the fact that suffering is random, if we can see a reason for its randomness, then perhaps we'll find some clue as to why there's suffering at all. It won't be a complete answer, but it might help. You see, I want us to consider what the alternative would be. Supposing bad things happened only to bad people, and every time somebody wanted to do something to hurt a good person, God had to step in and prevent it. Then what kind of world would we live in? Well, for one thing, life would get very unpredictable around me, because I'm always wanting to do bad things and God would have to be stepping in all the time to stop me. But that's not the main problem here. Supposing God was to do that, supposing every time I wanted to do something bad, God would step in to prevent it. And because God, we believe, to be faithful, consistent, perfectly fair and just, he would have to do the same thing every time I freely chose to do that wrong action. So in other words, if I've got free will and I decide to do something, I could force God to act in a certain way. And therefore, God is not sovereign anymore, because he's reacting to my free choice. So he is at the mercy of my free will. But let's suppose we live in a world where there's chance, where I can't predict the outcome of my actions, and I can't absolutely interpret everything that happens as an act of God, because there's inconsistency, randomness, unpredictability associated with everything. Then I can't force God to act in a predetermined way. And so this randomness, if you will, insulates me from God. I can't force his hand in a predictable way. Now, let me give you an example. I think our chairman is a computer scientist, and he will tell you all about the use of random methods in computer programming. And there are, for example, some programs that computers are pretty stupid, actually, and they just do what they're told. And you can write a program which is a series of instructions that will do something like sorting letters into various boxes. But for some reason, there are people out there who like inventing viruses, who will infect your computer with this virus so that it just goes round in a circle and never gets to the end of its task. It can get locked in a loop. You're nodding, that happens, doesn't it? Okay. So it would just go on forever and never finish what the program was designed to do, because this malign hacker has got into the system and gummed it up. Well, clever programmers do the following. They put into their program a random process. So every now and again, it goes blip for no reason, as it were. And if it's locked in one of these loops, it gets this random jump and escapes, and then carries on to finish its task. So the clever programmer builds in some randomness to make sure it's protected against this evil hacker. And in that way, he remains in control of the outcome of the program. So, in something like the same way, it's not an analogy, it's not perfect, But in something like the same way, perhaps God has put into our world a degree of randomness and chaos and unpredictability that prevents us from gumming up his world. It isolates God from our evil. But does that not mean that then God can't act on us either because of this randomness between us and him? Well, actually it doesn't work the other way around completely. Let me give you a reason why. And the issue comes up also in the whole concept of free will. Because free will seems to be difficult to understand if things are determined. William James, a thinker in the last century, came up with this very nice analogy to explain free will and how it could be consistent with the sovereignty and ultimate control of God. And he likened God's relationship to us as of a chess grandmaster playing a novice. We're the novices. And imagine you, as a novice chess player, playing against a grandmaster. Now, you can choose freely a move to make on the chessboard within the rules of the game. Okay, there are rules. But actually, there are gazillions of possible moves in a chess game. And you can choose anyone you like within the rules. It's totally free choice. But who's going to win the game? We know the grandmaster will find some way of countering whatever move we make as according to our free choice. So we can be both free to choose, and yet God can still be in ultimate control. Now I would like to extend James's analogy to the natural world and say that perhaps God allows the natural world to have a degree of freedom, and indeed us to make free choices. But whatever happens in the world, whatever avalanche, whatever storm, whatever fire or flood strikes, God can take that into account. Whatever choice we make freely, God can work with that. And that to me came as a great relief. I, in my first few years as a Christian, was deeply troubled by much of the teaching I was given about God's will for my life. There was a plan, I was told. God had a perfect plan for me. And I knew already I'd muffed it up. And I'd gone off it, and gosh. And I'd keep on doing that. What did it mean that God had a perfect plan for me if I kept fouling up and going the wrong way? And now I can see that actually all those mistakes that I made in the past and will make in the future, God can deal with them and God can work with them and bring about his purpose, even if it wasn't exactly what he would have chosen for me. So we're beginning to see a way in which God can use chance as a positive good in our lives, and that God can adapt whatever happens. John Sanders writes this: God has the love, the wisdom, the perseverance and power to deal with any situation that arises as God carries out his creational project. So let's return to Calvin and his allusion to sparrows. You may recall this comes from Matthew chapter 10. Where Jesus is speaking about the fact that not one sparrow, or he says specifically, are not two sparrows sold for a penny, and not one of these will fall to the ground without your father. Anybody know what goes after that? Without your father wills, or without your father knows. And translators have put one or other of those words there, but it's not there in the Greek. So the translators have kind of built in some kind of theology of providence here. On the one hand, God wills the fall of that sparrow and therefore is responsible for it, or without God knows. And that for me has a slightly different and very profound difference of connotation. that on the one hand, God is pulling every string, and on the other hand, God is there with that sparrow when it falls, and therefore he's with us when random chance things happen to us. Because the context, if you recall, of Matthew 10 is one in which Jesus is warning his disciples that they will face persecution and suffering and even death for his sake. But his take-home message was this: no matter what happens to you, even by chance — well, actually he didn't say that, but he might have done — whatever happens to you, you will come to no eternal harm. And that's what Jesus wants us to remember. In an uncertain world where unpredictable events happen, where we're the victims of chance and chaos, that we will come to no eternal harm. I think Rupert Brooke put it beautifully in his poem of the First World War. "Safe shall be my going, secretly armed against all death's endeavour. Safe, though all safety's lost. Safe where men fall. And if these poor limbs die, safest of all." We live in an uncertain world. We live in a world marked by chaos and unpredictability, and let's face it, by deep unfairness by our standards. But a world in which we are promised God's providential care, that God will be with us whatever happens, and we will come to no eternal harm. That I believe God has made an uncertain world for a reason, because it's only in an uncertain world that faith really makes any sense, that we walk by faith, not by sight. We don't know what's coming next, but we trust God. And that's only meaningful in a world that's basically unpredictable for us. And in that kind of world, we learn the meaning of faith and trust in him, in his love and his grace. And so what does this mean? What does this tell us about the God who made this world of uncertainty and chaos? Well, I believe it means that the creator of this world is interested in a dynamic, living, personal relationship with us, and speaks of a personal God. Because only a person will love, will forgive, will respond to our needs, our cries, and our experiences. And only in a dynamic kind of relationship, or dynamic kind of world and interaction, can a relationship grow of trust and obedience. So I think that God has put chaos and chance into the world for some very good reasons. One of which, perhaps the most important one, is to protect his sovereignty. That only in this kind of world can he really genuinely be in ultimate control and not simply reacting to us. But he deals with whatever we do, and he is free to choose the way he responds to whatever happens in the world. And most of all, I believe it gives each one of us, as we kind of stumble our way through life and we make our mistakes and we go off track and we suffer accidents, yet we have this unique, genuinely unique experience of God. And that's only possible in a world where chaos and chance is real. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord.
Professor Hewitt, for your talk. And I would just like to open up the floor to questions. Who wants to go first?
Okay. I just have a question, some assumptions which you had in your presentation. It seems that you support the thesis that there is direct continuity between this world and God, and by looking this world we can conclude something about God. But at the same time, ignoring the gravity of sin and the ramification which this problem has, which entered in a certain stage of history, which the influence of the sin on our consciousness, so our perception of reality and reality itself. So basically, maybe one thing to add would be maybe some cause of this chaos can also be not just God building in the world this chaos, but also the sinful sin and the effects of sin. And also that means that in order for us just to conclude directly from the nature about God, we would need to be in Eden, or we need to be later in heaven, or maybe we are not now in position to draw this direct conclusion, because we live in this transitional stage.
Yeah, I think you've built in some assumptions as well, if you may say that. But let's take what you're saying. And I agree with you absolutely that I am not saying that this is the perfect answer to all our problems. I'm not saying that I know the answer. These are some very difficult questions. And I wouldn't like to claim dogmatically that what I've said is correct. All I'm saying is that I do feel that what I've said makes more sense to me than a rigorous determinism of Calvinistic kind. And that's the most profound theological message that brings me a sense of comfort, not just because it makes me feel better, but because I think it's reasonable and it makes sense. And I always wanted to make my theology coherent and sensible. Now, you talk about the effect of sin in our lives and the consequences that has in the world. And I would agree with you that that is a contributory factor in the chaotic behavior of this world and our society. I didn't mean to imply that that we are free from blame, or that all the bad things that happen in the world are just happened anyway. Absolutely, we contribute to that. But I think it's worth perhaps remembering that God knows how much we have contributed and how much is just due to other factors outside our control. And that's, I think, worth bearing in mind if we feel that we have totally messed up. And if our heart condemns us, God is greater than our hearts. So that often there are things which cause us to sin that aren't totally our faults, that are due to our upbringing, our circumstances, maybe even our genes, that dispose us to certain kinds of reaction and behavior and circumstances outside our control. Only God can truly judge that. So I take your point that our sinful nature does contribute to the chaos, and I didn't mean to exclude that. But I'm talking about the kind of deeper background chaotic behavior of creation that I believe God may have a good purpose in.
Yes, okay.
First of all, thank you for a fascinating talk. I want to make sure I understand what you said. It sounds to me as though you're saying randomness and chance is part of, it's real, not an illusion, but it is part of something bigger.
Yes.
Okay. And that God's sovereignty is not compromised because he is still ultimately able to get his will.
Yes.
As the master in
yes.
the chess game.
Yes.
So I guess my question is, if God is still the master, still able to get his will, and knows the result of the sparrow falling, how is that any different, really, to not only Calvin, but Paul's determinism?
Well, I think, I suppose the difference is in knowing in the sense of purpose and knowing in the sense of retrospective fact, as it were. I mean, if you think of many of the prophecies in the Old Testament, I haven't done a count, but a large number of them are conditional prophecies. He says, this will happen if you do this. And if you do the other thing, something else will happen. And so God, in some sense, knows what's going to happen. And he can know in two ways. Either he can know because he sees into the future, or the future is visible to him. Or he knows because he will make sure it works out that way. And maybe there's a bit of both here, that there's some element of continuity and constancy that makes life possible. In other words, I think the standard response would be, I intend to go to Cambridge tomorrow. Or I will go to Cambridge tomorrow. Now, Cambridge will still be there tomorrow whether I go or not. So there's a certain openness to what actually happens. Part of it is open and part of it is closed and known even to God. But God may not know, in one sense, whether I will go to Cambridge or not. But Cambridge will still be there whether I go or not. So that aspect of it, Cambridge's existence in the future, is known. But my particular action is not known and may not necessarily be known to God in his interaction with this world. So I'm not saying that I am detracting from God's omniscience in the sense that there are things that he doesn't know. I think God knows everything that can be known. But if something can't be known, then not even God can know it. And it doesn't make sense to make a logical impossibility possible just by saying God can do it. And this is the way I think that one would have to approach it. I'm not saying that I can sign up to that 100%, but there may be an element of truth in that, that there's an openness to our future that God allows. And there may be some things that even God doesn't know, because they're not knowable by anybody. That's a big issue.
As I understand it, you're offering a particular form of the free will defense to the problem of evil. I'm not sure this is true of your defense, but something that's bothered me about the classical form is, how do we know that in the new world to come, there's not going to be evil? Or maybe there is going to be just less evil. Will there be no evil because we have no freedom? So, do you have a view about... And you've been talking about the world as we know it, but yes. Christians look forward to a new creation, heaven, whatever, and might thinking about what your theology is of heaven throw some light on this decision?
That's a very interesting question. It's something that my wife and I have discussed over many years, because it's an issue that she posed to me. If we as free creatures could rebel against God with our free will now, what's to prevent us doing that when we're in heaven or wherever we go, as it were, in the new creation, which actually I believe to be a new earth in which we will live? But that's matter of terminology. In that new life, in that eternal life with God, what is the nature of our free will? And the short answer is I don't know. But I can speculate that our nature will be different, that this life is a process of becoming. And therefore, I believe we're going to become something else. And I know that much of my sin is a side effect of the way I'm made. I've got hormones in me that cause me to think impure thoughts sometimes, because I have physical feelings. Okay. So there's a link between the way I'm made and some of the sins I commit. Don't ask me for any more details. But you get the idea that some of the sin that we encounter in our life is directly connected to our physical existence and our interactions with other people and our nature as self-centered creatures who are concerned for their own survival. And maybe that in the new creation, that link is broken in some way, and so that our free will is no longer under the same degree of attack and danger from those other effects. And I believe we will have new bodies, for example, that Christ's resurrected body was of a different nature. And Paul speaks of that, that we will inherit a new body that won't perish. So although it may be made of atoms in some sense, there'll be different kinds. And there are things that we haven't, perhaps not even able to understand yet, but we've recently been able to create all kinds of new states of matter, for example.
I completely agree with everything you've said.
Okay.
But can I just jump to what seems to me the really problematic?
Right.
So you're admitting that God can do it a different way.
Yes.
Where we do not have this difficulty with free will messing things up.
Yes.
So doesn't that cause the re-erection of the problem? Why did God create in such a way that our constitution, coupled with our freedom, caused there to be evil?
Well, you know as well as I do that's been a long-standing issue. And I know you're not expecting me to give you the answer tonight, but I don't know why my mother and father decided to have me. If they did, might have been an accident. I don't know. But I do believe
they didn't plan to have a professor of physics as a son.
So no, I'll tell you another story about that later. But I believe I was born out of love between them.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm in some sense a product of love. And for that I'm deeply grateful. And I believe we all exist because of God's love. And he created us to become something else, that this is a process of becoming, as I've alluded to earlier. And therefore, it's going to involve the transition from one state to one stage or state to another. I don't know why God could have just jumped all that and made us all his angels, as it were, if you like, and skipped all this trouble in between. And I don't have the wisdom and knowledge to say to God, well, you should have done it differently. I know a lot of people will do that and say, well, if I had been in charge of creation, I'd have done things differently. And all I do is I can trust God that there is a purpose for the way he has done things. That I was going to say, for example, when I was teaching my own children to ride a bicycle, for example, initially I held the saddle and ran along beside them so that when they hit a bump they didn't fall off and hurt themselves. And then gradually I released the grip, but I kept my hand just beneath in case they fell. I could catch them. And eventually they didn't want me to catch them, they wanted to do it on their own. And that process of learning to deal with bumps and random events to adjust their balance meant they could grow into a human being like me. So, but they had to do it. They had to go through this risky process of dealing with the bumps themselves. Otherwise, they would have become something quite different. They wouldn't have developed in the way a human being does. And so in some sense, I think maybe that's the way God has done it this way, that he wants us to learn how to trust him. He wants us to learn how to cope with the accidents and the uncertainties of life, and to live by faith and not by sight. This is part of his way of our souls growing and developing into a Christ-like nature. Because although we're made in the image of God, we're not quite his likeness yet. And so there's that process of becoming like Christ, that sanctification, that involves a process. God could have done it differently, but then we wouldn't be here discussing it, and this is much more fun.
I'll take hand in a second, but I want to ask a question. You, in response to Ken's question, you talked about maybe there are some things that God cannot know because it's logically impossible for him to know them.
But from what I heard, it sounds as though you're saying, based on the laws of physics, it may be physically impossible for someone, you know, within our universe and bound by the laws of physics, to know what is ontologically unknowable by chance. I mean, is there any reason for us to think that God would be bound by those things as well, as far as knowing what will happen? Or do you think that's just the same as making a square circle? I mean, like, isn't that, it's a physical impossibility, a logical impossibility, or do you think it's both?
Well, I'm suggesting that there may be a logical impossibility there, and one which God is quite willing to live with, as it were. That you see, this view, I think, of God and creation, for me, speaks of a much greater and more powerful God than one simply who has one fixed plan, and he pulls all the strings, and he's got this blueprint, and this is what happens. And that's one theological picture of God. But the vision I'm having is one which is a God who's much greater than that, that he can deal with a gazillion blueprints all at the same time, as it were, that we just can't get our heads around such a greatness of God. But nonetheless, that God has chosen to do it this way, and maybe that involves a kind of emptying of himself, or his willingness to take on this risk, that there are some things that he won't know exactly what will happen, but he can still be in ultimate control to make sure that whatever evil is released will be dealt with ultimately. And I think that's the promise of Scripture, that in the end of time, that God will wind things up and deal with evil, that it won't ultimately win, and that God will control it. But I mean, the short answer is, I don't know what God knows and he doesn't know. But it doesn't worry me that there may be things he doesn't know. It doesn't mean that God is any less. In fact, I think my vision of God is greater than a God who knows everything that's going to happen, because then there's a very limited number of things that can happen. In fact, it's just one. There's one universe with one history and one future. But our God is a God of infinite possibilities.
Thank you very much, James. I was just about to thoughts in my head, so I'm going to try not to hear the question. Basically, I'm interested in what you've been saying, how you would make sense of more structural sin or structural suffering, thinking of broader issues around social injustice or poverty, which I feel like there's levels of analysis, micro, macro, individual. So I don't see poverty, simplifying, you know, in ways which are deeply problematic, but I don't see that as a chaotic, random event. An individual, for example, in my country, in South Africa, might understand the fact that they are HIV positive as random, or as why me and not someone else. But when you study the disease and the epidemic and the way in which it operates, there's deeply historical, structural, socio-economic reasons for why that exists and why that persists. So my understanding of God and what is of God and God's nature and how God created us as individuals, I'm not sure that an understanding of chaos and randomness helps me in the same way to understand the nature of God in that context as it would why my father died, for example. So I'm just understanding, if you were to jump into those questions, how you would frame them using the same kind of language and paradigm.
I think it touches on the earlier question partly. And again, I would say that both processes can be at work. That there is, of course, in an individual circumstance, an immediately identifiable cause or reason why that happens. But it would not necessarily have been predictable. Everything has a cause in some sense, but sometimes the causes are not predictable. So that we could, on the basis of what we know, predict how many people in South Africa will develop AIDS in the next few months. But we won't be able to point to an individual and say, in 3 months you will catch AIDS. A lot of what goes on in society is based on the laws of statistics, basically, that individual events may not be predictable, but a large number on average can be. So there are, and it's those large scale trends or events, as it were, that can be understood in sociological terms because of social factors. In other words, if you create a society where 70% or 90% of the people are poor, then you can predict there'll be certain social problems that develop in that kind of society. And if you have only 10% are poor, the society will behave differently. That's certainly true. Those are kind of large-scale statistical laws. And if you take an individual within that, you might be able to predict how many road accidents happen, for example. But you can only predict the chances that one particular individual will have a road accident. You can't determine it. So both things are happening, and it involves some of the chance things here just because of our lack of knowledge. We can't predict what will happen because we don't have all the information. So it's a rather complicated picture, and all of these kinds of chance are at work. Does that help? No?
I like yes and no.
Perhaps you could rephrase your question in a sentence. Would you now try and answer in a sentence? I want to get to the heart of your question. Are you saying that?
I can't put it in one thing because I'm never good at simplifying anything.
Okay, three.
I posed it in relation to the question of sin and
yes.
and an understanding of, we're talking about the nature of God. So, like, fundamental to every human being is that the paradox that I'm born in the image of God, yet I'm broken and I'm alienated from God and people. So how, and then you take that and you understand the world and as it looks now. And so, yeah, like, how does the randomness and the randomness of God in relationship to sin and our free will? Like, it's kind of what we've been talking about the whole time, and I am just like struggling to have it make sense of that in relation to what you're saying. And I think I probably can't, and I don't have one question. Sorry.
Okay, no, I think I can see the kind of problem you're having, and I think that there's no one sentence answer to it. I think, as I say, all of these things are happening all at once, and that there are, the world is as it is, avalanche is happening. I could choose to be on that mountain and therefore contribute to my own demise because of my free will choice. So it's both my free will choice, it's my free will choice perhaps to sin in a particular way, and that will have consequences, it will hurt other people. And so they're all linked, as it were. And as I was saying to the earlier question, God will be able to unravel, as it were, how much is our responsibility, how much is our fault, and how much was our fate, if you will. And our, we do affect the world around us. And it's true, our sin does hurt other people.
I guess the question of our responsibility is probably...
Yes, and we are responsible for that. Yes, and I was taken to task by another audience on a similar issue because they seemed to think I was saying because God can respond to whatever happens, that lets us off the hook for global warming. Well, I'm not saying that at all. God will hold us responsible because we have free choices. We aren't forced to do exactly what we do. I mean, our free will isn't totally free. We are conditioned. Determined by other factors, but God will hold us responsible for the harm we do to His world. So, since very real.
I think we're almost out of time, and I see at least three hands up. So I'll just take two more questions. Start with Rob.
Thanks very much for your talk. I'm wondering you're engaging in the conversation about free will and free choice and determinism. I'm trying to sort this out myself. So how does that conception of freedom relate to what seems to be the kind of freedom that I read about a lot in the Bible, about sort of freedom from sin, freedom from slavery, for freedom Christ has set you free? Is that just a different concept of freedom? Is it related to free will and free choice?
Well, I think that Paul deals with that in Romans, doesn't it? And he struggles with the difficulty of behaving the way he ought to behave. He knows he should behave because he just physically doesn't seem to be able to do it. And the difference that Christ makes is that he gives us the enabling power to enable our free will, as it were. Mm. And that we have the possibility of overcoming the temptation. And that it's not that we lack the willpower. We lack the will. And if we had the will, God would give us the power. And so it comes down to our choice again, as it were. So living with God's help doesn't take us out of this world with all its difficulties, but we have his spirit to help us cope with what happens.
Actually, mine is partly a comment to see if you agree with it.
Oh, good. No more lies.
And the Stewart's question about in the new heaven and the new earth, will there be sin and the possibility of sinning? And as I see it, the process of sanctification now is a process of training us in righteousness. And the purpose of that training is that we may be able always to choose rightly. But then, when Christ returns, John in his letter says, when we see him, we will be like him. Because we will see him as he is. And so there, I think, will be the fruition of the training in righteousness, of transforming us, so that our deepest desire is not the sin. And so whereas the training was a process of making us able not to sin, that becoming deeply like Christ will be in answer to our deepest free desire to be not able to sin. And that will not be a loss of freedom, but it will be the fulfillment of our freedom.
Yes. Yeah, I think I would go along with that. A couple of caveats in the sense that our process of sanctification clearly is not uniform and not the same for everyone. People like me who haven't made much progress will have a lot more training to do afterwards than others, as it were.
Yeah, but the difference would lie in the effect we have on this world. But I would say God's grace is such that the beatific vision, seeing him as he is,
yes,
will be the same for all.
There's certainly something transforming about that new state and that new relationship with God. I mean, it's certainly true that if I were to be really aware of God's presence all the time, the way I am sometimes, then my life would be so much better. So, absolutely, I would agree with that. And there are things we have yet to learn and discover. And that's what's so exciting.
Last question. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe an analogy, one more human, limited analogy, but useful in this context, is a GPS in contrast with a map. So God doesn't just draw the map and this is the way you should go, but if you make mistakes, he has unlimited solutions to get you back. At the same time, you have the chance, you have also the opportunity always to reject the leading and not end up where he wants you to come.
I hope God's better than my GPS.
Well, I mean, I take that analogy I hear all the time. Recalculating.
All right, so can you just join me in thanking you?